You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into, and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's hosts.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I can feel it now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us.
News report from the RNC in St. Paul last week.
I've just been told that the police have announced that they will be dispensing tear gas unless this crowd disperses. Everything had been peaceful to this point.
Can I say something about violence?
Yeah. Go ahead, Michael.
Okay, the reason I think that Josh was right that we're not going to win with some sort of a violent uprising is because when you see these images on these streets of these two conventions, I'm going to use the conventions because they're fresh on my mind, the tear gas is still fresh on my chest. You walk through the streets of Denver, and I'm not talking about the protesters here, but you look at the citizens of Denver sitting outside of Starbucks, walking back and forth to work, taking the dogs for a walk, walking past 150 fully armed to the teeth riot cops without blinking an eye, without once questioning what the hell was going on their street. I talked to a few people and they said, oh, this is just what happens. This is just, you know, the convention comes to town, you've got to expect this kind of thing. So when we get to a point where the most American people just expect this kind of violence from the top down, there is absolutely no way that we can expect those people to understand bottom-up uprisings. There is, until they can understand bottom-up uprisings, and until the bottom can understand what that means, there is absolutely no way this would work, because this violence from the state is not even seen as violence. It's seen as defense.
Hi, Mike Cannon here. I'm still somewhere between shocked and horrified by what I saw and went through this past weekend in St. Paul during the RNC. Shocked and horrified on so many levels, kind of summed up by those two segments I just gave you. Somewhere between shocked and horrified by the state police violence I experienced myself. Somewhere between shocked and horrified by the lack of concern the average public knows or feels about what is happening in their own communities. Wandering between the dark alleys of shocked and horrified and still digesting it all. I, like many, many hundreds of people, were caught up in the police sweeps. Arrested, charged with a felony, forced to spread my cheeks, put on the little pajamas, and put into 23-hour lockdown for over 56 hours without being allowed to contact even a lawyer during that time, and then just released. Not charged, not cited, no bail needed, just released. Just like a vast amount of people who are arrested, just let go. I would love to tell you very specific things about my situation, but been advised not to talk about specifics of my arrest, at least not yet. However, my story is not unique, and I plan to bring you items this week, stories of what others went through, and offer perhaps some insights into what had happened in St. Paul. This week's show is a montage of items I found off the web about what happened this week in St. Paul. You'll hear my story is not unique at all. This show is not about my plight. I'm a former Marine. I can handle their abuse standing on my head. The Corps taught me well. But on such a large scale, blatant state violence against hundreds of innocent people is pretty outrageous. Don't get me wrong, there was violence on some of the protesters' side. Most a critique of capitalism and state violence, but most were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And what's worse, no one in general populace seems to know or even care about what happened, thereby normalizing state violence. A pretty scary thought. I'm not fully sure what kind of show it will be this week. Most of the items you've come to hear will not be played this week, as I try to show you, the listeners of the show, at least part of what went down in St. Paul last week. I think this week's show will only be a two-hour show. I might fit in Eat the State, but probably the only familiar thing other than This Week in Radical History you've come to know about the Mike Cannon, as I bring you segments and reports from the police riots in St. Paul. We'll start out this week's show with some great work done by another arrestee, Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!, and her crew's awesome efforts to document what happened. We start out with a report of corporate donors to the RNC and their efforts to rent out the police force to commit crimes against the protesters. Well, in essence, you'll hear that in a minute or two. And I'll be back after a couple of these reports to chat a little more. As always, I'd like to thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen to this weekly Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show.
Prosecutor for charging. And so it's that same type of preventive detention or a sweep where there's no effort to distinguish between who's caught up in a mass detention, whether it's journalist students from the University of Kansas being detained.
Kentucky, right. In fact, when I was arrested on Monday, just before the police wagon took off from this parking lot where the police had arrested so many on these PC riot charges, probable cause riot, a young woman from the University of Kentucky was brought in. And she's one of those who, they remain in jail? The two students and their teacher.
I believe they may have now been released. Uh-huh. But for instance, my neighborhood hardware store owner, Republican family, his son was out riding a bicycle, got caught up in a mass sweep, and just got out yesterday after being held for almost a day and a half. So not just journalists are being targeted and caught up, also caught up in sweeps, just citizens out in the streets are getting swept up, and there's no effort or mechanism on the part of the police to distinguish between who do they have evidence against to arrest and try to prosecute, which we can deal with in the court system, or do they just sweep people up and keep them in custody and let it all sort out afterward. In fact, St. Paul actually negotiated a special insurance provision with the Republican Host Committee so that the first $10 million in liability for lawsuits arising from the convention will be covered by the Host Committee. The city is very proud of this negotiation. It's the first time it's been negotiated between a city and the Host Committee, but it basically means we can commit wrongdoing and we won't have to pay for
it. Wait, one more time. Explain how the money will work?
They negotiated an agreement where the first $10 million in damages arising from any lawsuits against the city related to the city's actions during the convention will be covered by insurance or by the Republican Host Committee, separate from the city's own insurance coverage and own financial reserves.
So there you have private big business buying police brutality. Actually, there is nothing new about this. In recent past, Homeland Security funds have been given to host cities as part of that money, that taxpayer money, is held in reserve for police misconduct. Last week in St. Paul, at last count, there was 818 arrests. The vast majority of these arrestees were just released. The last RNC in New York, there was over 1,800 arrests, and the lawsuits against that city are still working through the court system. These lawsuits, in conjunction with the large corporate interests, are just part of the cost of doing business nowadays. A couple of weeks ago, New York City settled with plaintiffs for a gross $2,000 action by police. The settlement was $2 million. Each plaintiff, after lawyer fees, will receive $48,000. The cities have learned that local taxpayers don't like paying for their local police misconduct, so the federal government is giving grants to those events that cover police violence. And now in our capitalist system, we've just taken the next logical step. Have the benefactors of police violence pay for the entire protection directly. And this really is nothing new, of course. At the turn of the century, coal miner owners paid local sheriffs to hire Pinkertons to do their dirty work, like beat union organizers and bust unions. The only thing new now is that they signed city contracts ahead of time for renting the police violence. I'm going to break now and bring you This Week in Radical History, where I was able to draw parallels with historical events and insert appropriate short segments of reports about St. Paul last week. Listening to this 20-minute segment will give you, the listeners, a good general understanding of the historical and the events that happened in St. Paul. I'll be back at the bottom of this hour. Here's a segment I produce each week for the alternative media world out there, This Week in Radical History.
And I will tell them, we will tell them, Bella Ciao, Bella Ciao, Bella Ciao, 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 that our sunlight...
This Week in Radical History is dedicated to all my sisters and brothers who were with me, illegally detained and abused, while in custody, and to all the radicals on the streets during this past week's RNC in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Or on the TV, I'll say the sunlight drag me.
It's been just a few minutes since we were able to get away from the tear gas, which was a task in and of itself. I can say getting tear gassed is not fun, but even worse than that is being trapped. I don't know what was happening at the front of the line where the tear gas first went off, but it may be melodramatic, but that didn't feel it. Being an American.
Gonna rise up and take what's there. 'Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting September 8th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer, some more radical historical info came from the Daily Bleed website, and one audio segment was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This Week in Radical History for September 8th, 1883, Sitting Bull Tatanka Iyotek, whose position was being bypassed by the U.S. authorities because he firmly stood against the robbery of his native people, spoke at the celebration of the driving of the last stake in the Northern Pacific Railroad joining with the transcontinental system. He delivered the speech in his Sioux language, departing from the speech originally prepared with an Army translator. Denouncing U.S. government, settlers, and Army, the listeners thought he was delivering a speech of welcome and praise. While giving his speech, Sitting Bull would pause for applause, periodically bow, smile, and continue insulting and making asses of the audience and U.S. authorities as the translator delivered the original address. Also on September 8, 1971, the Attica prison riot occurred at the correction facilities in Attica, New York. The riot was based upon prisoners' demand for better living conditions. On September 13th, tear gas was dropped into the yard and New York State Police state troopers opened fire nonstop for 2 minutes into the smoke. Among the weapons used by the troopers were shotguns, which led to the wounding and killing of hostages and inmates who were not resisting. After the prison was retaken, officers for a week beat and mistreated the prisoners in Attica. Nah, never happens in prisons. Besides, we are so much better these days. Here's a very short interview of abuses suffered at the RNC in St. Paul, Ramsey County Jail. Last week, September 2nd, 2008.
So that we could receive food in Ramsey County Jail because we hadn't been provided food. 6 or 7 officers came into my cell, took one officer, punched me in the face right here where you see this bruise, and I fell to the ground, unconscious, and the officer grabbed me by the head, slammed my head on the ground, and I and reawoke me out of to consciousness. and I was bleeding everywhere. They dragged me to another detaining cell. They put a bag over my head that had a gag on it. There was a point where I went without food for about 12 hours. I had been coughing up blood and vomiting, and I fainted once because I wasn't receiving any food, and I was like dry heaving and vomiting. And one officer said that I was being bulimic. I was being called gay by multiple officers, called the princess. When they had this bag around my head while I was being tortured, I was concussed, and later I was in a holding cell in Regent's Hospital, and I had thrown up in the bag that was around my head, and I was begging them to take it off of my face, and they would not take the bag off of my head.
Also on September 8, 1974, President Gerald Ford pardons the trickster, beloved comrade Tricky Dick Nixon for any crimes he committed or may have committed while president, starting a long line of pardoning to cover up friends' illegal activities, like Ollie North, for example, and wait for this year's get-out-of-jail-free Christmas gifts from the Bush administration to his co-conspirators. More prisoner news in 1976. Prisoners take over three of the four wings of the Hull Prison in England, including Jack Prescott, in prison for his activities with the anarchist Angry Brigade. Their protests include conditions in a prison workshop where furniture is made for prisons in Iran. On this date 3 years later, 3,000 unarmed demonstrators would be killed by the CIA-sponsored Shah of Iran's death squads. This week in radical history for September 9th, 1590, Rebecca Limp, a wife of an accountant and mother of six, is burned at the stake as a witch in Germany. She is tortured five times before confessing of her crimes. When she attempted to poison herself to avoid more torture, the lawyer added the charge of attempted suicide to her witchcraft charges. Historians estimated that as many as 9 million European women were killed as witches in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries by the good old God-fearing Christians. Also on September 9, 1869, I despise you. I despise your order, your laws, your force-propped authority. Hang me for it. Louis Ling's last words as he addressed the court during the Haymarket trial. Lang was one of the eight men accused of the bombing of the notorious Haymarket riot. He was found guilty, along with four others, sentenced to be hung. Lang, however, had a dynamite cap smuggled into his cell, detonated in his mouth, cheating the state out of its glory. All the anarchists, by the way, hung and killed by the state for the Haymarket riots, were pardoned after their deaths, as the real evidence was shown as involvement by the police in the Haymarket bombing itself. Also on this date in 1917, anarchist Antonio Fornasier is killed by Milwaukee police for heckling a priest. His comrade, Augusta Marlini, wounded on the same occasion, dies 5 days later. 10 men and women are arrested for inciting a riot, later linked to a November 24th bomb explosion that occurred while they were still imprisoned. Despite of the fact that they were in jail at the time, each was found guilty and sentenced between 11 to 25 years of imprisonment. Then, as in today, from last week's RNC in St. Paul, Minnesota, this short outtake.
2007, we had a critical mass bike ride where 19 people were charged with these probable cause riot charges. Only five people, of course, were ever formally charged with anything. A case that went to trial, actually a person with the RNC welcoming committee was acquitted because video evidence showed the officers lying. Another client of mine charged with various gross misdemeanors. Cases were dismissed because the video showed officers were lying.
Two more items for September 9th, 1968. In a press conference, Mayor Daley makes his now famous slip of the tongue. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder. Lastly, on that date in 2002, that commie-loving Nelson Mandela dares to call the United States a threat to world peace. He is finally taken off the terrorism watch list by the United States government last month on his 90th birthday. Happy birthday, Mandela. Now that you're a 90, you are no longer a terrorist threat to the United States. This week in radical history for September 10th, 1901, feminist and anarchist Emma Goldman arrested in an alleged link to President McKinley's assassination. In this atmosphere of intense anti-anarchist hysteria, Emma goes into temporary hiding. Then, as in today, here's a short outtake from St. Paul last week.
About a year ago, we started an investigation into the RNC Welcoming Committee. That's a local anarchist group, and we utilized a couple of undercover officers and some informants, and worked hand-in-hand with some FBI sources as well. And it was clear that from the beginning, the welcoming committee was a group of anarchists who were interested in shutting down the convention through whatever means would be necessary. The blockades was their primary tactic, property damage was always on the table because, you know, this particular group believes that property damage is not a crime. They think it's appropriate considering the oppression of government on society. And we've studied their culture and.
Last comment. Is Monica afraid right now? Is she sorry she was involved with organizing protests around the Republican National Convention?
Absolutely not. She's going to continue her work because, I mean, the work she is doing is far more important than, you know, the legal consequences, whatever they may be. So, no, she's confident, she's strong, she's experienced. While this is an outrageous violation of people's rights, outrageous imposition on people's lives, it's nevertheless something which is not entirely unexpected, and she knew that going in.
When eight people that I know and have been working with for the last year are being charged with conspiracy and acts of terrorism, silence is not acceptable. There are no terrorists on this stage. There are no terrorists in the Ramsey County Jail. There isn't one of us. There isn't eight of us. We are all the welcoming committee, and we stand together today.
Lastly, for September 10th, 1945, Robert Goddard, father of American rocketry, dies. Found at his desk, pen in his hand, his heart seized up like a rusty chainsaw. The last entry in his diary scrawled, quote, "If you were to take the Nagasaki bomb and put it on my rocket, my God, the horror, the horror, the horror, I must go mad, it's the end of civilization," unquote. This week in radical history for September 11th, 1926 in Italy, a group of anarchists nearly kill Mussolini as his car passes. The bomb thrown bounced off the windshield and bullets fly by. 26-year-old anarchist Lucchetti, convicted and sentenced to 30 years, would die in prison. Anarchists helped unite World War I when the Black Hand of Serbia killed Prince Ferdinand. Perhaps if they would have been successful in this attack, they could have helped curtail Hitler in World War II. A lot of history and potentiality in anarchism. The power of freedom and the power of chaos are very potent forces indeed. Also on September 11th, 1970, Ford introduces the Pinto despite knowing the design flaw causes the gas tank in the end to explode in collisions. Ford reasons that correcting the flaw would cost the company $137 million and lawsuits to settle any claims would only cost about $49 million. So they decide not to change the design. That's the ethics of capitalism for you. Lastly, for September 11th, 1973 in Chile, CIA helps to overthrow democratically elected government, ending nearly 150 years of democratic rule in Chile. The CIA helps murder President Allende, folk singer Victor Jara, American IWW journalist Frank Turguji, and many, many others. Over 5,000 would die and many others disappear. All this orchestrated and conducted by the war criminals of the CIA and Henry Kissinger. 16 more years of repressive military terror would follow Chile as the CIA helps to install their man, Pinochet. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Root supporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, September 12th in 1977, South African anti-apartheid activist Steve Bantu Biko died just after being transferred to a prison in Pretoria. He'd been arrested almost a month before, and while in police custody, he suffered major head injuries and was chained to a window grill for a full day. Before his arrest, Biko had helped establish the South African Students Organization, which later evolved into the Black Conscientious Movement. Due to Biko's radical beliefs and strong influence in the community, the apartheid government of South Africa put a ban on him in 1972, restricting him to central areas, forbidding him to make public speeches, and making it illegal to quote anything that he said. Talk about censorship. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row. A crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know.
On September 12th, 2003, the man in black, songster Johnny Cash, cashes off for the last time. On September 12th, it is also political prisoner Leonard Peltier's birthday. Peltier is still in prison on trumped-up charges, enemy of the state. Kind of like these people, then and now. Here are short clips from last week in St. Paul.
On Saturday, police raided a home where members of Eyewitness Video Collective were staying. Members of the group were detained for over 2 hours. We talked about that on Monday. Well, yesterday, police armed with batons and battering ram entered a St. Paul office building that housed the offices of Eyewitness Video. Police claimed they were investigating reports of anarchists holding hostages in the building. Members of Eyewitness Video accused the police of blatant harassment and of using the bogus hostage claim to seek entry to their office.
My neighborhood hardware store owner, Republican family, his son was out riding a bicycle, got caught up in a mass sweep, and just got out yesterday after being held for almost a day and a half. So not just journalists are being targeted and caught up, also caught up in sweeps, just citizens out in the streets are getting swept up, and there's no effort or mechanism on the part of the police to distinguish between who do they have evidence against to arrest and try to prosecute, which we can deal with in the court system, or do they just sweep people up and keep them in custody and let it all sort out afterward?
Okay, a couple items for this week in radical history. First, September 13th, 1847, Mexico. The Irish of the Battalion of San Patrico fought next to the Mexicans against the U.S. invaders are executed. Even to this day, an Irish person in Mexico will be told countless number of times about the famous Irish martyrs who defected from the U.S. Army and gave their lives trying to save Mexico from U.S. aggression. The St. Patrick Irish Battalion, San Patrico Battalion, arrived with the invaders but fought alongside the invaded. These Irishmen, seeing and recognizing that the fight of conquest was not what they signed up for, and made their own fate. Many died defending the last monastery holdout without ammunition. These U.S. deserters, their faces burned by the U.S. military branding irons swinging to and fro from the gallows. Also on September 13, 1858, students at Oberlin College bravely free fugitive slaves from slave catchers. Lastly, in 1971, Dick Nixon's paranoia reaches a fevered pitch when it comes to Jewish backers of his Democratic rival. The White House tapes include several shocking anti-Semitic statements, reveals plans to target key Jewish political contributors with IRS audits. Today, Dick tells his chief of staff, Haldeman, Now here's the point, Bob. Please give me the names of the Jews, you know, the big Jews contributors to the Democrats. Could you please investigate some of these cocksuckers? That's your president's for you.
Either good or ungood, and the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Special thanks to the Radio Roots crew at WBAI, whose audio segment I used. Special thanks to all those great interviews during the RNC used, including great work by Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Crew, and all the alternative media segments I use in this week's show. Lastly, thanks to the Slingshot Organizer and the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website for both inspiration and information on radical movements. Got to run. So as always, and until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am forever yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon. I leave you now with Johnny's Mercy Seat song on the anniversary of him leaving prison for the last time.
Challenge or resist. In heaven his throne is made of gold. The ark of his testament is stowed. A throne from which I'm told all history does unfold. It's made of wood and wire, and my body is on fire. And God is never far away. Into the mercy seat I climb. My head is shaved, my head is wired. And like a moth that tries to enter the bright eye, I go shuffling out of life just to hide in death a while. And anyway, I never lie. And the mercy seat is waiting. And I think my head is burning. And in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is burning, and I think my head is glowing. And in a way I'm hoping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway, there was no proof.
and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is glowing, and I think my head is smoking. And in a way I'm hoping to be done with all these looks of disbelief. A life for a life and a truth for a truth, and I've got nothing left to lose. And I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is smoking, and I think my head is melting. And in a way that's helping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway, I told the truth, but I'm afraid I told a lie.
WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Welcome back. Okay, so we've got about an hour plus a little to bring you a little expanded version of what you've just heard. As I see it, we need to talk a little bit about three specific issues between now and the end, and they are not comfortable nor easy issues. One issue has to be the obvious and blatant attack of the media trying to cover police misconduct in St. Paul. A second issue we need to discuss is the idea that 8-plus anarchists are being held on terrorism charges. And the third is just to confirm to the listeners the abusive tactics of the police against people who just got caught up and had nothing to do with any violence at all. Although they are all kind of sort of linked, I think we need to start to talk about the latter and also talk about violence itself. Shortly I'll be bringing you a press conference that a pacifist was speaking about violence. So before that, let's just acknowledge that there was violence on the part of some protesters. Any and all violence on the side of some protesters was a critique of capitalism, be it confrontations of some against police violence and capitalism, or destruction of some property because of their capitalist. But be very careful when you single out violence by some protesters and not consider why. Let's start by talking about the smashing of the Macy's window, or the harassment of some Starbucks places that did occur last week. Now, I need to state that I'm not a spokesperson for anyone, and perhaps I don't fully understand the philosophy myself. And as a bystander, I can only logically deduce their reasoning. Note that in the Macy's case, they did not do some random neighborhood and smash some grandmother's window. Matter of fact, it would have been a lot easier and safer for said person, considering that everyone knows all the Homeland Security cameras placed in the city, and none were placed at grandmother's neighborhood. Second, there was a situation of a group of four, I believe, that pulled a car into the middle of an intersection, I presume to force delegate buses off their planned route. They chained themselves to the car somehow, knowing that they would be arrested after their efforts. Is this violence? The car was also somehow disabled as well, and it took over 2 hours to be towed away. So would you consider this a violent action? Perhaps the few protesters, and I can only presume here, that confronted a vastly superior armored riot cops are in response to the violence of the sweeps and the laws that they are breaking, that they've seen time and time again. I suspect that every time a mass arrest happens of innocent people, there will be those who feel that they must make a stand. If the cops don't have to follow their own rules and laws and continually allowed to perpetrate violence against innocent people, who's provoking whom? Again, I'm not trying to justify or rationalize anybody else's actions, just trying to show that there are at least some gray areas. I could go into the idea that the party in town that is paying the police force supported the war of aggression against a vastly marginalized country like Iraq and killed millions in our name. I could try to also go into the idea that perhaps they asked themselves the old paradigm, where are all the good Germans when the Nazis did what they did? But to try to answer these questions would require a whole couple shows of itself. And as George Carlin said,
give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "Joe, I voted." The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized. They're made to seem either to be communists or some sort of disloyal person. A kook, there's a word, and now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. So, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only answer.
I don't know. Maybe they think that Eisenhower had it right when he warned us about the military-industrial complex. Or maybe they take to heart what Ted Koppel once said.
No, Virginia, there is no Santa Claus, no Great Pumpkin, no Easter Bunny, and no Tooth Fairy. And as though that weren't bad enough, here's another shocker. The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. The United States is a superpower with enormous and divergent interests that it is committed to protect. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, for members of Congress to pretend that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York.
I suspect the, quote, anarchist, unquote, critique is much more complicated and sophisticated than that, and I'm sure I'm not doing it justice here. My point is only to shine a light on possible motivations for said, quote, violence, unquote. However, can anyone offer why police are allowed to perpetrate violence and break their own rules, and what does that mean to this country? If so, I'd be interested in hearing from you. Well, I'll stop now and bring you the press conference about the RNC Welcoming Committee and their designation as a terrorist group. You judge for yourself.
We just said we can address the buckets here.
Okay. I will speak to the first question in terms of Ivan's claim. I don't think anyone here knows of anything regarding explosives, and I think as has been said many times, I certainly don't know, and I can only speak for myself, but I was heavily involved inside of making this space like up over the last week, and particularly with regard to the buckets of urine, after the sheriff's department seemed to have such a fetish for scatology, we spent a long time thinking through and discussing with one another where this could have come from, and we finally did remember that there was an instance at a general town hall. We've been having many town halls to talk to local St. Paul residents to make sure that we touch bases with them in their community, to make sure that the activists coming in out of town would be in conjunction with the local communities here inside of St. Paul. And at one of these town halls, which we did in conjunction with other activists who've been organizing around, organizing marches and the like, they assisted us in organizing these town halls, and we were really there just to hear from the community. One person stood up in the background. I believe this was with Warehouse or Chapel in McAllister College. I'm not sure what time it was or what the date was that this town hall was. And this guy stood up in the back and he said, "What you guys really ought to do is throw piss Republicans." And everybody was sort of like, and he was sort of a sketchy figure. And I think we like may have mentioned it to one another. Remember the pee guy a couple other times since. But that is the only instance that this, the only thing we know of. And with regards to the buckets and buckets, yes, there were buckets of gray water. Folks who washed their dishes and wanted to save water had some buckets in their homes, particularly those who were extra concerned. There's no urine in those, and I believe instead of one instance we can confirm that somebody who was living in a garage didn't have plumbing going out to that garage. Again, they raided so many houses. One person who was living in a garage staying there or whatever in that room had a bucket that he had pissed. little bit in because you couldn't get access to the toilet.
I heard a lot about consensus. I mean, that's the whole point of your group, you know, non-hierarchical, there aren't leaders, there's always consensus. We see these hand signal process points up here. I was part of your group in terms of observing, and there definitely were violent tactics by some people. Whether they were active members of the core group of welcoming committee led leaders, I can't say. What I'm asking, though, is how do you personally feel that some people involved in the greater movement did engage in violent tactics?
I want to clear up one misconception briefly. The welcoming committee, the name the welcoming committee, only applies. Well, I mean, everybody can claim they're all Spartacus, right?
Right.
But we were simply at this center and at other places organizing medics. Like, the welcoming committee has never officially. We were not on the streets. There was no welcoming committee banner on the streets. So in terms of acts of violence, I really don't understand where those could have taken place. There's simply no location where those could have happened. And when the cops, like, you know, came in and smashed our faces against the floor, like, the only violence...
I'm talking about, like, on the street during that first day.
I can tell you that in the 18 months that I've been with the Welcoming Committee, I have been listening as a religious pacifist, as a nonviolence trainer, as someone with a reputation to uphold. I've been listening really carefully to what's been discussed in the welcoming committee. I've been listening to what's been talked about. I've been present at the action camp that was named in the affidavit. And I've been assessing all the time whether I want to keep on this track. And I've been answering myself yes every time I ask that question. The definition of violence itself is very slippery. In some cases, property destruction is considered violence, and some cases it's not considered violence by the very people that I work with the most closely in the peace and justice community. Second point, tactical innovation that I spoke about before for nonviolent direct action is not going to come from the center. It's not going to come from the folks who have been organizing marches and rallies and doing a good job of it and doing it well. It's not, but they're not the innovators. The innovators are the people who are dissatisfied with that model. And that's the people in the welcoming committee, and that's the people we invited to come here. I can tell you that I personally did not and probably wouldn't smash the Macy's window. But I'm not going to condemn the person who did it.
Why?
I don't know what's going to come of this. I think that
the window was placed. That was what resulted in it.
Okay. I think that there's a good argument that capitalism is a problem. Macy's is a capitalist.
So, part of the consensus process is also not interrupting, and I know that anarchist organizing is difficult for some members of the media to comprehend, but we have Trump right next to him about consensus process.
Talking about capitalism. Yes, I find capitalism to be a problem myself. Sorry.
I think you were addressing whether property damage counted as violence. You say you're not violent, somebody smashes a window in front of you, you have a problem with that.
But she wasn't there.
I wasn't there. I didn't see it. I don't know what happened. I will say, let me give you two examples. Smashing windows on the one hand, pouring blood on draft files on another hand. Now, both of those are property destruction. Pouring blood on draft files probably causes far more dollar damage than does breaking windows. Now, why is one condemned and the other not? It's not a matter of money. And it could be a matter of intent, but that, I think, really has to be judged on a case-by-case basis.
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
So, this is a switch. We're speaking to you, the media, and the public. And we've had a pretty strict media policy for a variety of reasons, and I want to talk about a couple of them, just to get us all on the same page. One of the things is the Welcoming Committee works on a consensus-based agreement policy, which means that, as a group, we make decisions together. If we don't agree, we don't move forward. And when we do agree, we do move forward. So it's really hard when you call up or you email and ask a question to one of us because no one person is the welcoming committee. No eight people are the welcoming committee. There are six of us here. Four of us have been released from jail, and four of us continue to stay in jail. No one of us is the welcoming committee. The other reason why we've been a little hesitant to speak to the media, or why this media policy has now changed, is because it's become personal. The welcoming committee has become a target from Bob Fletcher, Ramsey County Sheriff, and from a lot of other law enforcement agents all the way up the chain. This is an abuse of power, and when the abuse of power becomes this extreme, silence is not acceptable. When eight people that I know and have been working with for the last year are being charged with conspiracy and acts of terrorism, silence is not acceptable. There are no terrorists on this stage. There are no terrorists in the Ramsey County Jail. There isn't one of us. There isn't eight of us. We are all the welcoming committee, and we stand together today.
Down doors with guns drawn on families with their children at dinner time. Reporters and the media at large have been repeatedly targeted for repression. Activists have been abducted off the streets in unmarked vans and political prisoners held without access to medical attention. The state has never really bothered with ethical justifications for its violence, but now we see that the agents of the law don't even bother with internal consistency, ignoring the few rights they have pledged not to violate. Sheriff Bob Fletcher has unleashed a degree of repression that should embarrass and anger us all. It's worth noting that his second-hand man is in jail on severe corruption charges and expected to roll over on Fletcher.
Took a lot of time, so let me close.
Paid informants have a motivation to lie. I think that's very important to consider. I have not seen personally members of the welcoming committee who are my friends and loved ones commit acts of violence. They are some of the most loving people that I have ever been in contact with.
FSRN's Aura Bogada headed down to Ramsey County Jail yesterday, where a few hundred supporters were camped out, waiting for their friends and loved ones to be set free. Many were charged with misdemeanors and released yesterday on their own recognizance. She spoke with Sheriff Bob Fletcher about the terrorism charges that we reported on yesterday against the so-called RNC 8, about the tactics of his officers, along with federal authorities, that they used to infiltrate and gather intelligence on the group called the RNC Welcoming Committee.
About a year ago, we started an investigation into the RNC Welcoming Committee. That's a local anarchist group, and we utilized a couple of undercover officers and some informants, and worked hand-in-hand with some FBI sources as well. And it was clear that from the beginning, the Welcoming Committee was a group of anarchists who were interested in shutting down the convention through whatever means would be necessary. The blockades was their primary tactic, but swarming and seizing intersections and stopping buses and property damage was always on the table, because you know this particular group believes that property damage is not a crime, that they think it's appropriate considering the oppression of government on society. And we've studied their culture and just decided that it was clear they had criminal intent. So as we worked through the year, the threats and the possibilities kept increasing in terms of the types of actions that they were considering taking, even toward individuals as well. And at the conclusion in this last week, we executed some search warrants to take away some of the tools of the trade that would be available to puncture the buses and assault officers and different type of chemicals that are used in the trade, bottles of vinegar used to put on masks so that they're more resistant to the gas that might be used in dispelling civil disobedience, and of course slingshots. In Denver, there were a number of officers hit with marbles from slingshots, wrist rockets, and the tools of the trade, the maps, which they were color-coded to tell their people which intersections to block. And by removing a lot of that coordinating material, we were able to sort of cut off the leadership from the local anarchists that came in here, which many of them were, you know, expecting direction on that Sunday. And, of course, we did the search one on Saturday to remove that ability to have their spokes council meeting. They had a spokes council meeting set for 7:30 on Saturday, and everyone would get their assignments. And we wanted to remove that information before they got them. So what you really have is a little bit of a leaderless block here, you know, roaming the town looking for opportunity. But if you come to St. Paul and you're not familiar with the territory, it's not as easy really to figure out how to stop buses from getting around. In fact, one of the groups, Pittsburgh group, that set up a sleeping dragon at the 7th Street exit, really we let them stay there the whole day, because had they gone to the 5th Street exit, it's hard to find the 5th Street exit from downtown St. Paul, but had they gone there, they would have been, you know, possibly effective. But 7th Street wasn't in our plan. So the point of that is that the coordination was cut off from the group.
I read, I believe, in a newspaper that a lawyer was saying that the urine that was seized was part of alternative plumbing system. It was taken from underneath the house.
No. Well, I mean, we'll have to let that sort out. I'm sure people can make claims. There's all sorts of possibilities, but the urine was never the only part of our case. I think I have to run, though, now before we get swamped by other reporters. Is that okay? Thank you. Thank you.
Sheriff Fletcher outside the Ramsey County Jail. He spoke with me before other reporters started lining up to do the same. We will be keeping track of the RNC 8 in the weeks to come. You're listening to FSRN.
And that is FSRN's Aura Bogado speaking with Bob Fletcher yesterday. That's Sheriff Bob Fletcher. Well, to respond to what we just heard, we have on the phone with us Charles Samuelson. He's the executive director of the ACLU of Minnesota. Welcome to the program, Charles.
Well, thank you. It's good to be on.
Thank you for joining us. I suppose the thing of most concern in what we just heard and what has been reported and admitted by the police is the fact that activist groups were infiltrated by the police, and that has led to them conducting these preemptive arrests as well as other police actions. Can you tell us any more about that?
There's not much more that I know than what you've just said. It seems there were two people who basically were turned by the police and snitched on the group. I'm not sure of anything more than that. There have been some claims by some people that at least one of the confidential informants was also a ringleader and was the person responsible for a great many of the plans and strategies that turned out to be the same things that the police were trying to arrest them for.
Charles,
but I don't know if that's
between,
true.
There's a difference between the police infiltrating a group, meaning actually planting people, and people in the group turning into informants. You're saying that they were informants rather than being infiltrated?
It's my understanding that at least one of them was an informant. And it's also my understanding that that informant was somebody who was, I don't know how to say it, inciting the group to take these actions. But I don't know. How can I say this? This is all going to have to play out over the course of these trials.
Charles Samuelson, can you tell us some of the facts about what we've seen with such things as how many people have been arrested, how many people have been charged with felonies? We've also heard 8 people who have been charged with under state terrorism laws. Can you break out some of the things that we've seen through the arrest and these police actions?
Well, this is off the top of my head, so I'm going to be relatively accurate, but I might not be exactly accurate. There were in St. Paul about 300 arrests, and in Minneapolis about 100 arrests, and 102, I think. In Minneapolis, there were 2 people taken into custody, and the other 100 were cited with misdemeanors and then released. They weren't taken to jail. In St. Paul, there were 100 misdemeanors, it's my understanding, and about 200 felonies, which were dropped down to, well, a great many of those were released, and a great many others of them were greatly reduced. I believe the count is now 21 felonies and about 15 gross misdemeanors out of the 300 arrests in St. Paul.
How does this compare to previous conventions?
Well, it's the number of total arrests relative to the total number of demonstrators is significantly higher than in other conventions. For example, in New York, there were approximately 1,600 arrests and approximately 500,000 demonstrators. We had approximately 10,000 demonstrators, and we had 300 arrests in St. Paul, let's say. So the arrest numbers, though lower, are a higher percentage relative to the total number of protesters. Number two, the proportion of people arrested for misdemeanors was much lower than in the other conventions. Again, in New York, it seemed to me there was something in the neighborhood of 1,400 misdemeanor citations as opposed to 100 here. So basically, somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 90% of the people arrested in New York were arrested for misdemeanors as opposed to about 30% of, or maybe 35% of the people in St. Paul.
Do you think this was premeditated? Do you think the plan was to come in and to arrest as many people as they have?
I think if you look at Denver and if you look at the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, or St. Paul rather, and then you compare that to the 4 years ago cycle of Boston and New York, a couple things pop out. One, the police presence, both in Denver and in St. Paul, was much more aggressive. The police were heavily armored and were physically intimidating from the very beginning. In other words, as I said in an article in the Star Tribune newspaper, it was almost like the police were daring the protesters to have a physical confrontation. And that was also, from reports, that was also the case in Denver. That didn't seem to be the case either in New York nor Boston 4 years ago.
Charles Samuelson, Executive Director of the ACLU of Minnesota, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Well, you're welcome, and good luck, and keep up the good work.
A demonstration for peace instead brought violence. Police and gas masks surrounded protesters rallying against the Iraq War. Dozens were arrested as the crowd proceeded to march from the state capitol to the location of the Republican National Convention.
This is a republic! And in a republic, the government asks the people!
Hundreds of demonstrators are being prevented from joining the anti-war rally as riot police have blocked off several bridges in this city. Protesters cannot get down to the convention center, and U.S. voters say the freedom of speech is being violated, and the situation has all the makings of a police state.
This is what democracy looks like!
Demonstrators say police cut off the streets before the rally permit expired.
It's a sad state of the country when you have to be away from the police to feel safe.
America is supposed to be the land of the free and stuff, and look at this, and it looks like we're in a war zone.
This is obviously a police state. People are not, our elected officials are not doing what we asked them to.
As clashes ensued, two presidential candidates took to the stage, laying out their political vision. Republican John McCain, surrounded by glitz and glamour in St. Paul. Independent Ralph Nader, in a scaled-down venue across the river in Minneapolis. A talking point for both, Russia.
They invaded a small democratic neighbor to gain more control over the world's oil supply, intimidate other neighbors, and further their ambitions of reassembling the Russian Empire.
Nader says the provocation was ignited by McCain and his colleagues in Washington.
And we've been sending arms and other support to Georgia, and we're getting them ready for membership in NATO. The Russians see that as a hostile act on their underbelly.
McCain, the so-called maverick, continued his aggressive rhetoric when discussing Iran.
Iran remains the chief state sponsor of terrorism and is on the path to acquiring nuclear weapons.
Iran, that is surrounded west, south, east by U.S. military. Iran hasn't invaded anybody in 250 years.
Nader says McCain and Democratic candidate Barack Obama would both continue a militarization of U.S. foreign policy. The Green Party candidate will not be allowed to explain his position in the upcoming presidential debates. Officials say he does not meet the popular vote requirement needed to participate.
Having two people debating only limits it to a very controlled debate, and a lot of issues don't get totally covered.
The people should have a right to some more options in this country, just aside from the standard Democrat and Republican.
This is Nader's fifth run for the White House. In 2000, he received nearly 3 million votes. Some argued it prevented Al Gore from beating George W. Bush. With McCain and Obama neck and neck, the Nader effect may be a force to be reckoned with. Marina Portnaya, RT, St. Paul, Minneapolis.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.